Prices are going up because the demand for oil outstrips the supply for oil. Oil is going up because developing countries still use a lot of oil. Oil is going up because we use too much oil.
The demand for oil is outstripping the supply for oil. We may get some answers about this nonsense tonight when we talked with D.C.-based psychoanalyst Justin Frank, who 3 years ago wrote the book, Bush on the Couch. He'll be joining us at the beginning of the next hour. And we do have more on sounds from Freedom Fry-loving Mensa Man. Yeah, that's right. All of a sudden the French are the good guys now. All the French had to do is get rid of their crappy former premier and come up with one who wants to bomb one of Bush's targets, this time Iran. So all of a sudden, the French and the Americans are friends again. No more freedom fries. Pat Robertson endorses Giuliani. Bush embraces France. Don't you feel like you slipped down the rabbit hole today? I'm late for a very important date. No time to say hello, goodbye. I'm late. Next hour, Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch, will join us. Pat Robertson and Rudy Giuliani, talk about an odd couple. Oh, my God, Rudy Giuliani and Pat Robertson.
In an interview on the Christian Broadcasting Network in September, Mr. Giuliani discussed his religious views in more detail than he often does on the campaign trail. He said, quote, I believe in God. I pray to God. I pray to Jesus for guidance and for help. I have very, very strong views on religion that come about from having wanted to be a priest when I was younger and having studied theology for 4 years in college. It's an area that I know really, really well academically. I understand the history of religion. Man and women's relationship to God is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, motivating thing in human history. Oh, God. That's Rudy. Pat Robertson, after the bombings in New York and at the Pentagon on September 11th, Pat Robertson agreed with the still dead, thank you, Jesus, Jerry Falwell, who suggested that abortion, gays and lesbians, liberals and secularists had angered and pissed off God. Robertson in 2005 called for the assassination of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. Robertson said, if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think that we really ought to go ahead and do it. And he said that the threat to the United States from activist judges was, quote, probably more serious than a few bearded terrorists who fly into buildings, end quote. In his endorsement, Mr. Robertson framed the biggest issue facing the nation as the threat of Islamic terrorists. Today, Mr. Robertson warmly praised Mr. Giuliani as, quote,
a proven leader who's not afraid of what lies ahead and who will cast a hopeful vision for all Americans. Here is Pat Robertson in his own words. Talk about strange bedfellows. This may be the oddest couple yet. Pat Robertson, who blames cross-dressing, homosexual-embracing social liberals like Giuliani for causing 9/11 to happen, endorses Giuliani because 9/11 happened. Only in the mind of George Orwell, does it get any weirder than this?
The overriding issue before the American people. To me, the overriding issue before the American people is the defense of our population from the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists. Our second goal should be the control of massive government waste and crushing federal deficits. Our world faces deadly peril: nuclear-armed North Korea and the foreboding of nuclear arms in Iran, deadly violence from Hamas and Hezbollah against Israel,
boom,
the possible overthrow of Pakistan's government, and drawn-out wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Boom.
In all of the crises which confront our nation and the world, we need a leader with a bold vision who is not afraid to tackle the challenges ahead. For months, I have contemplated our future and the outstanding group of men who are offering themselves to the Republican Party to be its standard bearer in the 2008 presidential election. Today, it is my pleasure to announce my support for America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, and a proven leader who is not afraid of what lies ahead and who will cast a hopeful vision for all Americans.
Amen and amen and amen. To me, he says, the overriding issue before the American people is the defense of our population from the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists and the gays and the liberals and the ACLU and People for the American Way and crossdressers and who else? People that get that ugly operation. Ooh. Ooh. In all of the crises which confront our nation and the world, we need a wife-cheating multiple divorcee who has a bold vision and a closet full of modest but tasteful dresses. And I don't mean Hillary. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, you know what I mean. Today is my pleasure to announce my support for America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, and a proven leader who is not afraid of what lies ahead and will cast a hopeful vision for all Americans. And, you know, stranger still, Giuliani accepted the endorsement of this wacko. He'll do anything, Giuliani will, to appease the religious nutballs who are wandering around this country like, I don't know, like lepers out of the Bible, right? Oh, hello, help, I'm... Oh, by the way, federal prosecutors are scheduled to seek a grand jury indictment tomorrow of Bernard Carrick, the former New York City police commissioner and good friend of Giuliani's, on a list of charges that includes tax fraud, corruption, conspiracy counts. A grand jury in New York has been hearing evidence about Mr. Carrick for about a year. Also, prosecutors will charge Carrick with failure to report as income more than $200,000 in rent that is alleged to have been paid on his behalf to use an Upper East Side apartment where he used to have sexual relations with women other than his wife. Criminal charges could complicate the Republican presidential campaign of former Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Mr. Carrick's friend, patron, former business partner, whose mentorship was responsible for Mr. Carrick's sharp ascent into positions of public prominence. Mr. Giuliani declined comment. Through a spokeswoman today, we think it was a woman, she had a very tasteful yet very conservative dress on, but said he is not worried about the impact such a case might have on his campaign. Why should he? He also today picked up the endorsement of God's own torture boy, Pat Robertson! Mr. Giuliani appointed Carrick, a former New York City detective, to a series of positions within Giuliani's administration as mayor, finally naming him police commissioner in 2000. He later recommended him to Bush as Homeland Security Secretary in 2004. Son of a bitch. This is how weird it's gotten. And Pat Robertson, this filthy, degenerate jackass who has a spot in hell right alongside the hole that Jerry Falwell now rests in upside down while scorpions eat his feet. Pat Robertson endorses him and Julie stands there with that dung-eating grin on his face. So the Christian Coalition endorses a guy who has cheated on all of his wives, forced his children to leave the house because he, Giuliani, was banging his girlfriend upstairs while mom was trying to sleep on the couch and the kids were trying to do their homework. Ah! Excuse me. I've got to sit here and laugh.
No one seems to care. This old world is a closing in. There's no hope anywhere. I'll never sing a sad song again, 'cause I'll be gone to heaven's golden shore. I'm a
got the flying monkey right blues? Here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
It is Wednesday night, prayer meeting night. Put on your best dress and go to church. That is, if you're Rudy. This stuff is slowly driving me mad, and I understand that. Maybe it is driving you insane too. My favorite television guy Keith Olbermann refers to some of these clowns like Rush Limbaugh as the comedian Rush Limbaugh, and I really respect old Keith Olbermann because he can do that. He can refer to them as comedians. Or that particular slime ball in particular. But, I just take it way too seriously, I guess. Huh? Did you see the thing in yesterday's New York Times, A Vote for Justice, where Charles Schumer wrote an op-ed piece where he tries to justify his endorsement of Mukasey to be the next attorney general? Let me give you a couple of quotes for it, and then I have something else I want to add to you. He says, I'm voting to support Michael Mukasey for attorney general for one critical reason. The Department of Justice is a shambles and is in desperate need of a strong leader committed to depoliticizing the agency's operations. You're kidding, Charlie. You've got to be kidding. He goes on to say there is virtually universal agreement, even from those who oppose Judge Mukasey, that he would do a good job in turning the department around. Chucks, so would I. Most important, here's the part I like. Most important, Judge Mukasey has demonstrated his fidelity to the rule of law, saying that if he believed the president were violating the law, he would resign. Okay. Should we reject Judge Mukasey, President Bush has said he would install an acting caretaker attorney general who could serve for the rest of the term without the advice and consent of the Senate. Advice and consent of the Senate to a Bush attorney general? Oh, how's that working for you, Chuck? Huh? How's that worked the past 7 years? Y'all doing the, huh? You getting together with Ashcroft and Gonzalez? Did you have good time? Oh, Jesus. To accept such an unaccountable attorney general as one appointed by Mr. Bush, I believe, would be to surrender the department to the extreme ideology of Vice President Dick Cheney and his chief of staff, David Addington. Ooh, booger bears. Judge Mukasey's refusal to state that waterboarding is illegal was unsatisfactory to me and many members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Congress is now considering, and I hope we will soon pass, a law that would explicitly ban the use of waterboarding and other abusive interrogation techniques. And I'm confident Judge Mukasey would enforce that law. Chuck, you can't be that stupid. Aren't you a federal prosecutor? Huh? Former prosecutor? Chuck! International and U.S. law prohibits torture and other ill treatment of any person in custody in all circumstances. Already! The prohibition applies to the United States during times of peace, armed conflict, or state of emergency. Any person, whether a U.S. national or a non-citizen, is protected. It is irrelevant Whether the detainee is determined to be a prisoner of war, a protected person, a so-called security detainee, an unlawful combatant. And the prohibition, Chuck, is in effect within the territory of the U.S. or any place where U.S. authorities have control over a person. In short, Chuck, the prohibition against torture and ill treatment is absolute. Schumer, it's already a law! My God!
Here's the U.S. law. The United States has incorporated international prohibitions against torture and mistreatment of persons in custody into its domestic law. The United States has reported to the Committee Against Torture that, quote, every act of torture within the meaning of the convention is illegal.
Illegal, Chuck!
Under existing federal and state law, and any individual who commits such an act is subject to penal sanctions as specified in criminal statutes. Such prosecutions do in fact occur in appropriate circumstances. Torture cannot be justified by exceptional circumstances, nor can it be excused on the basis of an order from a superior officer. End quote. Military personnel who mistreat prisoners can be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The War Crimes Act of 1996 makes it a criminal offense for U.S. military personnel and U.S. nationals to commit war crimes as specified in the 1949 Geneva Conventions. A federal anti-torture anti-torture statute enacted in 1994 provides for the prosecution of a U.S. national or anyone in the U.S. who, while outside the U.S. or in the U.S., commits or attempts to commit torture. Torture is defined as a, quote, act committed by a person acting under the color of law specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering upon another person within his custody or physical control. And a person found guilty under the act can be incarcerated for up to 20 years or receive the death penalty if the torture results in the victim's death. And on and on and on. And Charles Schumer says, well, you know, if the Congress passes a law against torture, you know what? I just know in my heart, I have a feeling in my bones that Judge McCasey would uphold that law. Bless his heart. I'm going to vote to confirm him.
We stand together to win the war against terrorism. Our country is strong. None of us.
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Don't forget, coming up in about half an hour, Justin Frank will join us, the author of Bush on the Couch. Meanwhile, what's Putin's latest move? Just thought I'd drop this in. Russia's lower house of parliament voted unanimously today to suspend Russia's participation in a key European arms control treaty. This was insisted upon by Putin, because Putin is getting very pissed off. And there's one thing you don't want, I would imagine, is a pissed off Putin. He has more unproven oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, and he also has just a whole clutch of nuclear weapons. But the vote in the State Duma, which is the Russian lower house, the vote was 418-0. It's just like the days of the old Soviet Union, huh?
418-0.
Approving legislation under which Moscow would temporarily abandon its obligations under what is called the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. That was agreement that has been in effect for 17 years. That treaty limits the number of tanks, aircraft, and other conventional weapons in Europe. So Putin has said, screw this. His decision to suspend his country's participation, of course, is being driven less by security concerns and by an increasingly confident, I love the way the Associated Press puts it, an increasingly confident Russia's desire to emphasize to the West that its interests cannot be ignored. Putin announced plans to suspend his country's participation in that treaty last July because Russia is very pissed off over U.S. efforts and promises to build a so-called missile defense system in Eastern Europe. And the fact that so many countries in the former Soviet Union are now part of the Western Alliance. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. I thought we were all friends now. Speaking of friends, Bush met with Sarkozy today, the French president. This man is,
sacré bleu. This man is soon to be a divorcé.
Eh? After thanking Sarkozy for his newfound friendship, Bush took some questions from the press. And actually revealed that he actually did. He did. He did. He picked up the phone and he called Mushy to tell him to hurry up and take off that uniform. Reporter says, Mr. President, you came down so hard on Burma and other nations for their crackdowns on pro-democracy demonstrators, yet you seem to be giving Musharraf a pass. So the question, Mr. President, is why are you going soft on Musharraf? Is there a double standard?
I spoke to President Musharraf right before I came over here to visit with President Sarkozy. And my message was...
What? What?
That...
What? What?
We believe strongly that in elections.
Uh-huh.
And that you ought to have elections.
And get your clothes off. Yeah.
And you need to take off your uniform. Pakistan has been on the path to democracy. Burma hadn't been on the path to democracy.
It hadn't been.
And it requires different tactics to achieve the common objective.
Get undressed.
And as I told you, I just spoke to President Musharraf before I came here. My message was very, very plain, very easy to understand.
Just strip, damn it.
And that is the United States wants you to have the elections as scheduled and take your uniform off.
Son of a bitch. I live in the third ring in hell. I really do. I've been moved to the third ring of hell. In 53 seconds, he tells Mushy to take off his uniform twice. Holy Christ, what is up with these people? Dana Perino, too much cappuccino, says it. They're all saying it.
Take off your uniform.
Take off your uniform. Musharraf is probably over there going, what the f*** do these people mean? Take off my uniform? Oh, my God. Somebody drops a floating cliche, not a cliche, but a floating... what am I looking for? Take off his analogy, a meme. There you go. They drop a meme in front of him. Take off the uniform. Oh, I like that. Take off your uniform. Take off your underpants. I like that. Next, a French reporter asks about the Q word, quagmire in Iraq. The reporter says, Mr. President, this morning you talked a length about Afghanistan, Iran, but not Iraq, and I want to ask both of you, is France reconciled with the United States? Is the United States reconciled with France in Iraq? Can France, for instance, Mr. President, help to get out of the Iraqi quagmire and President Bush? Do you have a timetable for withdrawing troops?
You know, quagmire is an interesting word.
What is it in French?
If you lived in Iraq and lived under a tyranny, you'd be saying, God, I love freedom.
Or, God, I miss my legs.
Because that's what's happened.
Or, God, I miss my children.
Having said that, we had a difference of opinion.
Or, Allah willing.
But I don't sense any difference of opinion now that a struggling democracy wants help from those of us who live in the comfort of free society.
Someday I'll have a home again.
And, Mr. President, the strong gesture of sending your foreign minister there wasn't a message to the United States, because we're good friends.
It's freedom prize.
It was a message to the Iraqi citizens.
Monsieur.
That said, we hear your cries for freedom. We want you to succeed. Because one of the lessons of history is free societies yield peace.
And lots of oil, too. And you know, oil is... Why am I talking like this? I'm not French. You're French. I'm a dumbass from Texas. We hear your cries for freedom. And your cries from the waterboarding tables. And your cries from the boxcars. And your cries from the secret torture rooms. And your cries as we blow up your children and murder your spouses and just do all kinds of bad things to you. Yes, we hear your cries. Last one from the chimp in chief before he and Sarkozy took a beignet break. This time, Mensa man waxed poetic on the price of oil. He just gets smarter by the minute, doesn't he? This guy is just, whew, oh, oi, what can I say? The reporter says, Mr. President, with oil approaching $100 a barrel, that is about...
I have to interrupt you. This is the worst French accent I have ever heard in my life.
Mr. President.
And just on behalf of my French teacher, I am pleading with you to stop. Plus, this was an American reporter,
oh.
So please.
Well, once you get into this, it's hard to get out. Mr. President, with oil approaching $100 a barrel, which is about 46 euros, are you concerned that your hard words for Iran on its nuclear program are helping drive up oil prices, which can end up hurting the U.S. economy?
I believe oil prices are going up because the demand for oil outstrips the supply for oil. Oil is going up because developing countries still use a lot of oil. Oil is going up because we use too much oil. That's why the price of oil is going up.
This is your brain. This is your brain on Bush. Any questions? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The price of oil is going up because the supply for oil is not going up? Is that what he said?
I don't know. My brain hurts. I think he said the price of oil is going up because the supply for oil is going up.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, and you may be interested in this. You may not. I don't know. Catholics are strange people. They really are. No offense to any practicing Catholics out there listening, although I don't think there are too many left anywhere that speaks English. In Louisville, Kentucky, the Louisville Metro Police have cited Dr. Paul Shum, the principal of a local Catholic high school. They've cited him with loitering for the purpose of prostitution. Here's the story. You decide. On the night of October 30th, that's the night before Halloween, the night before Halloween night, well, whatever. On the night of October 30th, a police officer patrolling a neighborhood known for narcotics trafficking and prostitution spotted Dr. Paul Shum in an alley at 23rd and Stone Street. However, instead of wearing a suit and tie, his daily attire at Bethlehem High School, police say Shum was dressed to the nines in drag. The patrol officer observed the individual dressed in a black leather woman's outfit with fishnet stockings, fake breasts, a blonde wig, and he had on lipstick. That's according to Louisville Metro Police Department Detective Phil Russell. Mr. Russell went on to say, the officer talked to the individual in the car and asked the individual what he was doing in the alley. He provided a couple of answers, but none seemed to be legitimate to the officer. So he reasoned that the only purpose that he had to be in the alley that night, dressed that way, at that particular hour, was for the purpose of prostitution. It was not until the end of the stop that a sergeant recognized this individual and knew him to be the principal of the Catholic high school in Bardstown, which is the county adjacent to Metro Louisville. The case has stirred a lot of controversy in Bardstown, known as the first center of Catholicism west of the Appalachian Mountains. Oh, really? I didn't know there was such a designation. According to Shum's bio on the Bethlehem High School website, he holds a Bachelor of Science from Center College, a Master of Arts in Teaching from the University of Louisville, and a Doctorate of Educational Leadership from Spalding University. Prior to becoming principal of the school, he worked for 26 years at St. Xavier High in Louisville, and prior to that, he worked for 3 years as a stripper at Boomers, a drag club on the east side of town.
And the one thing they say about Catholics is they'll take you as soon as you're warm. You don't have to be a big footer. You don't have to have a great brain. You don't have to have any clothes on. You're a Catholic the moment that came. Because every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets...
Oh,
Got the Flying Monkey Right Blues? Here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
Yes, indeed. 10 before the hour, Florida Representative Robert Wexler sent his constituents the following email today. And this comes from afterdowningstreet.org, so it's not something you're going to have to go check at scopes.com. Wexler writes, as a person who supports holding this administration accountable for their deceptive actions, you may be interested to know about the recent votes in the House regarding House Resolution 333, entitled Impeaching Richard B. Cheney, Vice President of the United States for High Crimes and Misdemeanors. I share your belief that Vice President Cheney must answer for his deceptive actions in office, particularly with regard to the preparations for the Iraq War and the revelation of the identity of covert agent Valerie Plame Wilson as part of political retribution against her husband. That is why I voted against the motion to table debate on H.R. 333. Along with only 85 other Democrats, I opposed tabling the measure and supported beginning immediate debate and a vote on the Cheney impeachment resolution. The vote on tabling the Kucinich resolution was rejected, and the House subsequently voted to refer the matter to the Judiciary Committee. Vice President Dick Cheney and the Bush administration have demonstrated a consistent pattern of abusing the law and misleading Congress and the American people. We see the consequences of these actions abroad in Iraq and at home to the violations of our civil liberties. The American people are served well with a legitimate and thorough impeachment inquiry. I will urge the Judiciary Committee to schedule impeachment hearings immediately and not let this issue languish as it has over the last 6 months. Only through hearings can we begin to bring a correction of the abuses of Dick Cheney and the Bush administration. And if it is determined in these hearings that Vice President Cheney has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, he should be impeached and removed from office. It is time for Congress to expose the multitude of misdeeds of the administration, and I'm hopeful that the Judiciary Committee will expeditiously begin an investigation of this matter. Please feel free to contact me if you have any further questions or concerns. I sincerely appreciate your input and hope you will feel free to contact me anytime I may be of assistance to you. In addition, I hope you find my website, wexler.house.gov, a valuable resource in keeping up with events in Washington and in South Florida. With warm regards, signature Congressman Robert Wexler. Okay, wexler.house.gov. Wait, you're not in his district, are you? You can still get in touch with him, you know you can. But you see, this is all it requires. As Wexler points out, as you've pointed out, as I've pointed out, as so many writers in the blogosphere have pointed out, all that needs to happen, is for the impeachment hearings to begin. Witnesses shall be summoned. Questions will be asked. Testimony will be given. And as the testimony develops, as the case develops, it will be apparent even to Republicans, not in the House, that Dick Cheney is a law-breaking son of a bitch who needs to be removed from office. This is all that it takes. Let the articles of impeachment flow from the testimony, and then let us see.
I sound like I'm in Congress. Then let us see
if there's any member of the Republican caucus who will vote in favor of retaining a lawbreaker. You see how easy this is? This is what Kucinich wanted to happen 6 months ago when he filed articles of impeachment with the Judiciary Committee and nothing happened. That's why he took his point of privilege and took it to the floor of the House. And now it is back with Chairman John Conyers. Wexler's ready to go. Kucinich is ready to go. How many people on that committee are ready to go? All they have to do, this committee, is to begin hearings on the crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors committed by this murderous cyborg bastard that operates somewhere in some twilight zone that is not executive, not legislative, certainly not judicial, in some parallel dimension to the area the rest of us have to exist in. He plots wars. He plans all sorts of poisonous activities to destroy the Constitution, to take America's soldiers into a death hole, to commit hundreds of thousands of people to an early death. This bastard has to go. All Conyers has to do is begin the hearings. That's all. Subpoena the witnesses. Ask the questions. Let the American people decide.
Well, there's a novel idea.
Let the members of Congress decide, including Nancy Pelosi, including the hundred and some Democrats who voted to throw this down the toilet. Just begin the hearings. That's all that has to happen. Let the testimony flow. Let the people decide. Even Republicans not in the U.S. House, will hear evidence that displays for anyone with an IQ above that of a gently stewed rhubarb stalk that Dick Cheney is a criminal. Dick Cheney needs to be impeached and then tried in the Senate and have his ass kicked to the curb. I don't care who they bring in. I don't care if they bring in Jeb Bush as the new vice president. I don't care if they bring in Giuliani. It doesn't matter. That's then. This is now. All they have to do is to begin the hearings in the U.S. House, in the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House. That's all. That's all. Justin Frank will join us after the break. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Dr. Justin Frank is the author of Bush on the Couch. Came out about 3 years ago. He is a renowned psychoanalyst. And according to what Google.com says, he assembled a comprehensive psychological profile of President George W. Bush using the principles of applied psychoanalysis, the discipline of psychoanalyzing public and historical figures pioneered by Freud. Dr. Frank fearlessly builds his case, which concludes with a most disturbing diagnosis. Joining us now from somewhere out there in the real world is Dr. Justin Frank. Dr. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
My pleasure. In the time since this book has come out, a little over 3 years, have you changed your mind?
not at all. What's so interesting is I feel as certain about George Bush as he feels certain about everything else. I've really not changed my mind. When the book first came out, a lot of people were concerned that it was not scientific, and I tried to say that psychoanalysis is a mixture of a careful study, but there's something artistic, but how can I prove things? Well, it's actually that he has proved everything in the book, and it's like without knowing it consciously. It's like he's unconsciously used my book as a playbook for the last 3 years. It's quite disturbing. His contempt for law, there was a chapter on that in 2004. His bullying people and the smirk, I mean, that just got more and more evident with all the torture things that have been going on. So, you know, nothing has really changed. I think that what's been happening in the last year or so is that he's feeling a little more cornered and a little more anxious. And I think that as he does that, he escalates his determined state of staying on the course.
Yeah, that is what is putting this country, certainly our Constitution, but this country and arguably a huge chunk of the world at risk. Would you give us a working or a clinical definition of a sociopath?
Well, a sociopath is a person who there's the way they present in terms of symptoms and then what their psychodynamics are. Their symptoms, or what you notice, is that there's a tremendous absence of guilt, that they're able to do something without feeling any guilt. They show no conscience, so they can pretend to be one thing to one person, another thing to another person, and change without really having it bother them at all. They're in many ways seen in, you know, criminal elements in our society. There are people who are in the longest range definition of sociopath. A sociopath is somebody who really has a history of guiltless living. And they, as I said, they seduce you verbally. The dynamics of sociopaths are people who have essentially unconsciously and not, and even consciously sworn to hate their parents, to have contempt for the world around them. And what they do is they, psychodynamically, they project, meaning they put into other people views of themselves. So in other words, they might project a shame-filled part of themselves and then bully or attack it. So for instance, if George Bush is afraid of shame, for instance, it would be shame for him to ever cry or show any weakness or be dependent or express any kind of neediness. He projects his neediness into other people and then attacks them for being weak and vulnerable. And it's a way of protecting himself from feeling shame. So the most dramatic and the simplest example, really, it was on the campaign in 2004 when he was at the airport in San Francisco, and he was in June, and he made this comment about how he was tired and he was looking forward to going back to Crawford because he wanted to get back to the lump in bed waiting for him.
Referring to his wife.
And referring to his wife. So this is a way of seeing her as a lump waiting for him when he was the one who was, in many ways, had to be with her and couldn't be without her. And so he projects his own lumpness and then treats it in a joking or contemptuous way, depending on how you look at it.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. So what a sociopath does is then that by doing that, they've gotten rid of ever having to feel concern about other people. So they can have false empathy, but they don't really have genuine empathy, and they don't have concern. And sociopathic people are unable to feel empathy, except they're able to psych out other people so they can figure out other people's weaknesses, because some of their projections are accurate. So if they project vulnerability into a vulnerable person, they may be accurate to some extent, but the degree of the vulnerability is completely enhanced by their projection.
You have written that Bush remains mired in a long-standing pattern of denial and blame, and that responsibility is something that he avoids at all cost. Is this possibly where his guiltlessness comes from? If you are not responsible for anything, how can you be guilty?
They go together, exactly. The guiltlessness comes from his ability to deny responsibility. And his need to deny responsibility is a way of evading shame, guilt, and punishment. and they go together. So the more he evades shame and punishment, the more he denies responsibility. The more he denies responsibility, the more he is without guilt and without shame, and he's not accountable. It's a reverberating process.
Mm-hmm. Much of what you have written has been certainly taken apart, parsed all over the internet and in various non-internet reviews. It must have been a strange proposition for you to decide to use certainly valid techniques, but to analyze someone with whom you certainly are not going to have a face-to-face. I think Bush even said at one point during the 2004 election or the 2000 election, he was not going to put himself, quote, on the couch. Which may be where you got the title for the book.
It's actually the other way around.
Oh, is it?
He said that because he knew about the book.
I see.
That 1 month after the book was published in the 2004 campaign.
I agree with you implicitly and explicitly. I think this man is, I would go further. I think he's absolutely, totally insane. But I'm not a clinician, so it's easy for me to say. So I agree with everything that you have written about this guy. On the other hand, how do you make these sorts of evaluations when you don't really have him there to talk? You know, everybody knows this. I did 10, 12 years of therapy myself, and I know the long, drawn-out process and how deeply you can get into self-examination and how far the clinician has to go with you to come up with, if not a diagnosis, at least a path out of the thicket. So how do you do this with a historical figure you're not going to really sit down with?
Well, first of all, I didn't have 10 or 12 years to write the book. So,
right.
I have seen patients for 10 or 12 or 15 years, and I've been a patient myself in analysis for mm-hmm. at least 10 years.
Right.
So I very much know it from both sides of the couch, as it were. But the way to do it is the technique is something called applied psychoanalysis, and it was actually done first by Freud early on when he analyzed some famous historical figures, very famous ones, Moses and Leonardo, Da Vinci, not DiCaprio, and analyzed them and wrote about them two books.
Mm-hmm.
And the technique is essentially trying to apply psychoanalytic principles to every bit of information we can glean from the person or about the person.
Mm-hmm.
So we read everything they wrote. We look for their life history, for patterns, for their relationships with their parents, whatever it is that they've written, whatever it is that they've done. And this is how you work with people you can't get in your office, in your consulting room. I am deprived of the best tool, which is obviously personal contact.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a long tradition of doing this. In fact, Roosevelt hired a psychoanalyst to analyze Hitler in mm-hmm. 1942, and he wrote an analysis of Hitler. And the reason Roosevelt did that was he felt that he would have a better understanding of Hitler so he could negotiate with him after the war. Both men died before the war was over, but that analysis still was in the Hyde Park Library. And the CIA started hiring analysts to analyze foreign leaders in the same way I did in my book. Mm-hmm. So there's a long tradition for it, but it's essentially making use of every bit of information. I decided to only use public information. I do practice in the Washington area and have seen a lot of politicians over the years
mm-hmm.
and might have learned things that nobody knows about different people, but I've decided to only use public knowledge and public information because I think it's very important to work with the material that's available to all of us to help us really think about Bush. It's not like an expose of finding some secret. So what I do is I look at all of Bush's videotapes, everything he's written. He had written two books with help, but he wrote two books.
Mm-hmm.
All of the WhiteHouse.gov, all of the press conferences, go over and over and over them. I mean, he's a very public figure, even though a lot of his appearances are choreographed. You can still learn an awful lot about him. And so then you look for patterns in their life.
All right, we have to take a break here, Dr. Frank. I'd like you to consider, you've written that Bush experiences people around him as destructive or a source of danger. And when we come back, maybe you can address, where does that come from? That, to me, is a very clear definition of a sociopath. And let's talk about that when we come back. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, who is the author of Bush on the Couch. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Put him in a straitjacket, there's no doubt. Let the psychiatrist figure him out. Listen while the demonstrators cheer and shout. We'll all feel better in the morning.
Past the hour. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, published about 3 years ago. He's a Washington, D.C.-based psychoanalyst and professor of psychiatry at George Washington University Medical School. Dr. Frank, the question that that we had on the table before the break, we may have just lost our connection here. Damn it!
No, I'm right here.
Oh, there you are. Okay.
It's about destructiveness.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you've written that that Bush experiences people around him as destructive or a source of danger, and to me that sounds extremely paranoid.
Yeah.
Where does that come from with Bush?
Well, I think one of the things that's very important that cannot be overemphasized, and I think the most painful thing for the American people to think about, is that this is the first time we've really actually had a cruel president who is destructive and who enjoys being cruel. And he has a lifelong history of being destructive. I wanted to take issue with something that you said earlier, though, before the break, which was about, because I don't entirely agree about him being totally insane. He's insane in certain ways, but in other ways, he's very effective as a president in terms of getting what he wants. He wants lower taxes. He wants to have this war. He wants oil prices to go up. He wants to help the pharmaceutical companies, and he's gotten almost everything he's wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, he's extremely effective. So, but what is harder to accept for most people, including us, is how destructive he is. And when my book first came out in June of 2004, about a month or two later, a couple of different mothers of boys who were killed in Iraq, soldiers, called me up at different times and asked me if I thought that Bush was destructive enough to actually want their sons to die.
Mm.
That was such an overwhelming question to me,
mm-hmm,
that I said, what have we come to as a nation when the mothers of children in war actually think that their president is malevolent towards them? I mean, we've never had that feeling before with a president, even with Nixon.
Right.
And I think that Bush is the most destructive president in terms of his willful pleasure at destroying things. Now, where does that come from? Again, I think it comes from the same source, which is his hatred of anything that is shameful about himself. When he was 7, his sister died. She was 3.5.
Right.
There was no funeral. There was no mourning. There was no talk about her. Her name was Robin. He was left to his own devices. And it was like the parents started with a second family because Jeb was 2 months old when the sister died.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like he was sort of cut loose and must have been identified with Robin and didn't get very much attention. So if you don't do mourning, and Robin he was very close to actually, if you don't get to do any mourning, you feel that crying is a sign of weakness. You feel that having any sense of loss or grief is a sign of being pathetic, because his parents never cried, they never grieved, nobody seemed to get upset in his family. So what's he going to do with that? Well, one of the things you do with those feelings is you start becoming cruel to other people to make them look like weak, people or, you know, crybabies. So
Dr.
You,
Frank, I've got to take another break. Can you stay a little
I'm so long-winded.
No, that's all right. No, this is very interesting. Can you stay a little bit longer?
Yes, I can.
All right, let me put you on hold. We have a break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and continue the conversation with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Cowboy disease, red cowboy disease, red cowboy disease. You won't find the funny when they go and kill these pigs. Red cowboy disease, red cowboy disease. Please put them all in paddock them.
You know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
We get a little crazy. 25 before the hour, we're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. He is a Washington-based psychoanalyst and professor of psychiatry at George Washington University Medical School. That little sound clip just played. Dr. Frank, we promised to restore chaos. How many of those malapropisms or whatever they are, how many of those really come from a part of George Bush that means exactly that?
Well, I think that I think a tremendous amount of them do. I think that his aggression is curtailed overtly from the people, hidden as best possible. All of his speeches, all of his appearances are choreographed. His office, his audience is always vetted and selected, and torture is done outside of the states and completely externalized. However, it comes through in his speech, not just in his behavior of bombing and killing women and children in Baghdad, but it comes out in his speech on a regular basis, what Freudians call slip of the tongue, where he says actually his unconscious intention on a fairly regular basis. I mean, one of the more recent ones, he said at Fort Benning, was, you know, the best way to defeat the totalitarian of hate is with an ideology of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, an ideology of hate, excuse
right.
me.
Right, right.
I mean, this is a person who is essentially speaking the truth of his own unconscious, and it does come out all the time. I see that as a symptom, not just as an indication. It's a symptom of several things. One is the massive anxiety that he has, that he has to control to keep these destructive parts of himself from just taking over and being visible for everyone and to everyone. And that it also indicates that the truth of his unconscious conflict. It indicates his contempt for language and for communication. There's sort of almost a chaotic, relaxed quality about the fact that he's comfortable making these slips all the time. I see it as a symptom of something very serious. And in fact, in my book, I wrote that the consistency of the slips is like the smoker's cough.
Mm-hmm.
It's a symptom that sort of looks harmless at first, but it's usually an indication of something very seriously wrong. Which is the case with him. He was always a destructive boy and man, verbally sadistic and cruel, cruel to animals. He would brand pledges when he was in the fraternity house with a hot coat hanger on their buttocks when he was a senior. That was written up in the New York Times, in fact, in 1968. He has a long history of this kind of behavior. And it really is a destructive bent. There was a cartoon in the Globe 2 days ago where the White House was in the center saying, thank God we're safe. And all around it are these little burnt patches of land with little writing on them, like Constitution, dollar. I don't know if you saw that cartoon. But this is a person who I think you hit on something very important, which is that he's fundamentally destructive. And there's pleasure in breaking things. And he likes to break things. And I think people are beginning to understand that and see that about him. Signing statements are a form of breaking things. He's essentially saying, I don't care. You can pass whatever law you want. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to go along with it.
But are you not making the case for if the word insane is too clinical, a non-sane?
Well,
because what you're describing and what most of us have witnessed, because we have had front row seats to this man for 7 years, as you point out just a second ago, this indiscriminate bombing and killing of civilians, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, it doesn't matter. And
right.
I don't think there is a more bloodless term in English right now than when it's applied to civilian casualties as collateral damage.
I agree with you.
It's just a horrifying term. So is this not a person, though, who is not sane? I don't want to belabor the point, but...
Well, he's not sane by most standards, but medically, okay. I think he should be examined and evaluated. I actually have always said this for years. They could do projective tests, they could do Rorschach tests, they could do all kinds of tests to see about how in touch or out of touch with reality he actually is. But what I'm saying is that he's also extremely effective. He gets a lot of people to go along with him. And that his cruelty takes many forms. One of them is indifference. So on the one hand, he bombs Baghdad. And on the other hand, he lets people of New Orleans drown. It is. It can take an active path. It can take a passive indifferent path. Both of those are malignant and malevolent and extremely destructive.
And also to someone like me, it's very, very, very frightening, very
yes.
scary to know that the leader of the country in which I live is this bizarre and has the capability
yes.
of doing anything. All the talk about the attacks on Iran or the use of so-called tactical nukes, this is astonishing stuff, and it scares the hell out of me.
And I'm sure that part of why people don't confront him directly is they just hope he'll go away in a year, and they just want him to go. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because they are afraid. I've never seen more afraid people than the Democratic Party these days, at least
officials. Is that one of the reasons for the hesitancy to impeach this guy?
I think he should be impeached immediately.
Oh, I do too, but I mean the hesitancy of Pelosi.
Yes, the hesitancy is one of the main reasons is fear. I think
really?
People are afraid of him.
Really?
And I think they're afraid of him. And you know, one of the things that I think there are some people who understand this better than, you know, a lot of people who do better than I do, but they understand the psychology of torture. One of the things that people who write, who grew up in lands where torture was used overtly, you know, like mm-hmm. say in Argentina or something, they see torture as a way of keeping their own citizens in line by mm-hmm. letting you know the length to which your government will do to inflict pain and suffering on your own people. And in a way, I think that creates a kind of fear. There's like a message. So like being willing to tolerate torture and being willing to tolerate Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo lets people know that, you know, you better not say anything against him because you could be next. I mean, every time I give a talk, somebody will say to me one of two things. Thank you for being the cannon fodder for the rest of us. And the other thing they'll say is, you know, you better watch out. You might be sent to Guantanamo. And I've never felt unsafe about doing that, which is interesting given how frightening Bush is.
Sure.
But I do think he gives the message that you're not safe. And that the reason he gives that message is obviously to maintain power. But it's also a projection of the fact that he doesn't feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has never felt safe, and he tries to inflict his insecurity on the rest of us. This book, you didn't mention this, but part of the reason we're talking is that my book has just been reprinted in paperback with the second reprinting, actually, with an updated afterword and introduction that goes all the way through the elections of 2004, 2006, Katrina,
mm-hmm.
Even up to the
my
surge.
Bad. Yeah, my bad. I wasn't aware.
That's yeah. Well, I had hoped my publicist would have said your book, but it just came out last week,
uh-huh.
And it's available everywhere. But the idea about it in the afterword and the last bit that I've written is really very much about his cruelty and his destructiveness, and it really has kind of come together in a very mm-hmm. clear pattern, and including his mocking of the Democrats and his, you know, the first thing he ever said to Nancy Pelosi in public was he'd like to help her decorate her office. Now, if that's not a put-down,
but, yeah.
It was just unbelievable. And they laughed.
Yeah, yeah. Let me, first of all, let me acknowledge something. You sound like you have a hell of a cold.
I do have a cold.
And you're really struggling with this interview. I appreciate the fact that you're doing this.
Thank you.
If you can stick, can you stick around?
Yep, I'll have a little club soda and I'll be fine.
Okay, all right. Let me ask you this. Given what you just said about Bush's unsafe feeling in his world, that he is unsafe, he's under threat, and for all the reasons that feeling is there, that mindset is with him. Have you at any point tried to explain the relationship between Cheney and Bush?
Well, I haven't spent a lot of time on the relationship between Cheney and Bush. I get asked that question a lot because people do see Cheney as the kind of mastermind and
or Bush's id.
Than Bush's id. Well, I think he's actually Bush's ego.
Oh, really?
In that he's the one who gets things done. And Bush is this kind of little boy charmer who gets Cheney to do his destructive bits. It's more like, well, Rove, I thought, was more like Bush's penis. But
right.
But it's like you get people to do your dirty work, and he would outsource it to everybody. A lot of people used to call Bush, they would tell me that they thought Bush was a puppet and Cheney was running the show. And I said, that may be true, but you have to remember one thing. He is the puppet who chose his puppeteer.
That's very true. I got an email here from, we have people that have questions for you, but I've got
sure.
a couple of emails. Blah, blah, blah. Why would it not be possible, John in Alexandria, Virginia writes, to hospitalize Bush or have him committed to a facility? We're talking about the deaths of thousands of human beings. Is that not enough cause?
You're talking to the right person in terms of, I think it's a reasonable cause. I think you're not going to get anybody to do it. You're not even going to get anybody to ask him tough questions in a press conference. I've been trying to get other psychiatrists together to talk about this man in a way that talks about him as being unbalanced and dangerous. I've been approached by ex-CIA people who are very frightened of him after what he did with Valerie Plame, and they've contacted me, and we wrote a paper together in July called The Dangers of a Cornered Bush, and that's been published around. It's essentially what would happen if he got cornered. I think he should be hospitalized. I agree. He's got to be evaluated. Who's going to do that?
Yeah, that's true. Let me put you on hold for a second, Dr. Frank. We have to take a break here. We'll come back and continue the discussion. We're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
The best way to defeat the totalitarian of hate is with an ideology of hope, an ideology of hate.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, who is the author of Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. He is a Washington, D.C.-based psychoanalyst and professor of psychiatry at George Washington University Medical School. How long can you stay with us, given the fact that you probably feel like hell, Dr. Frank?
Well, I got a bit of a cold. I could stay another 5 minutes or so till the top of the hour, but I've got also have a 7 o'clock patient tomorrow morning.
All right, I got you. Got
so,
a couple of quick
I
ones.
I got to get a little sleep.
I hear
before
you.
Before I start working.
Very quickly, Article 4 of the 25th Amendment,
as
one of our emailers has sent in, remove him for being incompetent in the medical sense.
Yes.
Is that a possibility, or again, does fear play in here where no hearing would be held for that sort of thing?
I have been trying to get a group of psychiatrists together who know me, who know my work, and who I respect also, who would be willing to make a public statement that he needs to be evaluated. And it's been very hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
people are just, they don't want to do it.
Is it because...
And I think it's fear. I think it's, you know, the comfort of, you know, living a professional life where you don't, you know, make waves. I'm not sure what it is. It's interesting because the psychiatrists, like in Argentina, are political activists. Many of them speak out. I don't know what to do about it. I think that I agree with the emailer, I mean, Article 25 and the 25th Amendment and Article 4 is very much about incompetence. And in that sense, he is incompetent to govern. And when you were talking before about insane, I think one of the elements of his incompetence is his inability to perceive reality, that's material reality. He really
looks
at something and sees it as so different from what most people see.
And that's, to me, is a working definition of insanity.
Yes, that is.
Let me get in your opinion, of course, since that's what we're looking for here, the relationship between Bush and his parents. I've said on this program that part of Bush's bloodlust for Saddam was because his dad didn't get him, or for whatever reason.
I think it's the other way around.
Oh, really?
Well, his bloodlust for Saddam is to prove his father a fool for not getting him. It's
right.
Not to at all redeem his father, because he hates his father, and he has hardly any contact with him. I think that his bloodlust for Saddam is also driven by very... it's interesting because all of the people around him, they want to get rid of Saddam because of oil and money. Like people like Cheney and Condi Rice and all those people, they're from the oil business, and he is too. But his bloodlust is much more sadistic and crazy, and it's a perfect match because he is the person who does want to have his own personal vendettas, and it really has to do, again, with a fear of being terrorized. He hates other people who at all look strong, and he wants to defeat them and destroy them. This is the ultimate example of a bully, and I don't think it's bloodlust to get rid of Saddam, anything about his father other than that he wants to prove that Saddam is evil and it's not him, Bush, who's evil. In other words, it's a way of saying, I'm going to get rid of Saddam, but who he really wants to get rid of is his father.
All right, we've got.
I'm sorry to say all that.
No. That's
how I think about it. But the point is that
it all makes sense.
The danger is that he plays it out on the world and on the rest of us. We all have psychodynamics, but we don't play them out on other people and maybe in our own family.
That's right. Not
but
on the world.
But he does it on all of us, and it's very terrible.
2 minutes left here. How much danger are we, just as the United States, how much danger are we in as a result of his failed policies in just about every single arena since he's been president?
We're in a terrible state, and we're in a couple of dangers that people aren't paying attention to. One of the biggest dangers, I think, is trying to elect somebody who's exactly the opposite, like a woman or an African-American, nothing against either Clinton or Obama, but we're looking for something that's totally different. And I think what's important is to recognize the part of Bush that exists in all of us, that we all have our own little fantasies, sometimes our bloodlust, we yell, kill the umpire, we have different kinds of fantasies and feelings. And I think that if we brush it under the rug by just saying we'll have somebody totally different, we're not going to ever grapple with how he got to be this powerful in the first place. It's not only that he stole the election or the Supreme Court. I mean, it's easy to blame other people, but I think that, you know, when you see the Democrats kowtowing to him in Congress, you begin to wonder, what is going on here?
Yeah, really. And that leads me to one last question, and we've got about 30 seconds here. Do you think he'll give up power in 2008, given his executive orders and signing statements?
I think it is an interesting question, and I do not know whether he would give up power. I would not be surprised if he brought all the Blackwater people back to town and said, we're going to stick around for a while. It would not surprise me. I think he will give up power, but it would not surprise me if he didn't. I don't mean to hedge my bets, but...
No, I understand.
You know, there's no way to predict, but it would not surprise me.
Dr. Frank, thanks, especially given the fact that, really, I had a cold like the one it sounds like you're dealing with, and it is nasty. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Well,
and,
I'm glad you had me, and this is good.
Let's talk again.
Okay.
All right, sir. Take care.
Bye.
Dr. Justin Frank, author of Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, And there is a second printing out now with some updates, so you might want to check it out. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. Stay with us. All of a sudden, I feel very, very uneasy. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. I'm sorry. That was a scary interview. Very scary, and apparently some of you were as freaked out as I was. Just a couple emails here, then we're going to go to your phone calls. Catherine in Sacramento writes, Mike, the interview with Dr. Frank was fascinating. Dr. Frank's analysis makes sense of Bush's bizarre behavior. I just wish Dr. Frank could analyze the Americans who voted for Bush twice. And those hardliners who continue to support the sociopath. How can we help Congress overcome its fear and do something about this heartless, sadistic bastard in the White House? I don't think we can. I really don't. Randall in Phoenix. Mike, please ask Dr. Frank what measures we can put in place to make sure this type of mental case does not get to the office ever again. Well, I think the answer to that is just I don't think we can put any measures in place. I just think that we Americans, and I know this is a part that is starts sinking into platitudes and half-witted statements given the condition our condition is in. But we Americans have got to be a little bit more selective in who we got to pay attention. We're not paying attention. Again, I remember I was working in Chicago in 1999 when this sick bastard, his campaign was being pushed by every neo-fascist in the country, and I got something that the Nation published that was just a record of his record in Texas as a one term and reelected governor of Texas, and it was horrifying. And I went on the air every single night and talked about this. And Kathy, if you remember, this is before email. Well, there was email, but it was before the internet was so easily manipulated. And I kept saying, if you'll send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, I'll send you a copy of this little list. Jesus Christ! I think we got 500-700 requests for that. Remember, it was just unbelievable. I don't know. We don't pay attention. We don't pay attention. And I also like what he said about going from one extreme to the other. I don't mean I like what he said. I was fascinated by what Dr. Frank said. You know, we have this crazed white male who truly is a danger to everything and everybody in this country and on this planet. And if we decide to run as far as we can from him and elect somebody who is a person of color or a female as an expression of that, I hadn't thought of that. I don't know. KC writes, will Bush give up Commander-in-Chief? Bush said that Musharraf can't be both president and head of the military. Does the same go for Bush? If so, he should either give up the presidency or his status as Commander-in-Chief. Well, but they're one and the same in this country, and Commander-in-Chief is not the same as the head of the armed forces. As a matter of fact, there's some very clear differences between Bush's role in the military and, say, Musharraf's role in the military. Let's see. What else? A couple more here. Mary in Denver, Mike, if there's time, I'd like to hear Dr. Frank's explanation of why so many Americans have not sensed the pathology of Bush, when so many others of us cringed the first time we saw or heard him. How do we develop radar for this? Again, Mary, I think the answer would be the same as what I just said. We've got to start paying attention as a people. We've got to not pay attention to the sizzle, but more of what it is being cooked. And I don't know. I don't know if that's possible anymore. There's a part of me that really doubts it, that if we get effective leadership in this country, it's going to be almost by accident. Or if we're willing to work toward the long-term goal of replacing members of Congress, the senators and representatives who have no business being there. They're just shills for corporate America, whether they're Democrat or Republican. In most cases, they're Republican. In all cases, they're Republican. But there are a few Democrats, too, who have no business being in a position of writing laws and trying to govern this country. If we can ever get to the point where we have an executive who will not appoint politicized halfwits to the Supreme Court. Christ! I mean, if you look at some of these people on the U.S. Supreme Court, they have no more business, they have less business being there than I do, or you do. It's astonishing. But my fear is, and it's legit, we don't have the stick-to-itiveness, as my grandmother used to say, the stick-to-itiveness to see this through. We just don't care anymore. You care. I know you care, and I care. But the majority of Americans don't care. You know, yesterday was Election Day here, right? We didn't even talk about how the Do Nothing Day went. Obviously, it was a huge, smelly failure. But we had Election Day here in Atlanta. Like many communities did, not in the city of Atlanta, but all sorts of municipalities and counties in the metro Atlanta area. Early returns show that 90% of eligible voters said screw it, didn't even show up. We don't care. We don't care. Edward writes, hey, Mike, I don't feel like a loony now. The hair on your neck stood up just like mine. There's no way in hell Bush will give up the power. A bully hates, really hates, exposure for what a coward and fool he really is. This country is in it, in for it, before we get rid of this wackadoodle and his friends. That in reference to the question to Dr. Frank, is Bush going to give up power? And Jesus, when Frank said he's not sure, it's an open question. That was scary, because if that happens, if there's a refusal to give up power as constitutionally mandated, then a lot of us are going to stop screwing around, and there is going to be trouble. There will be trouble in this country. There will be serious trouble. There will be serious trouble. And you can read between those lines any way you want. James Drisser wrote, if you could get the doctor's comments on the Mullen definition, whether he agrees with it or has it been replaced, updated, discounted since its development. A standard definition of delusion is attributed to this person, Mullen. A delusion is an abnormal belief. Delusions arise from disturbed judgments in which the experience of reality becomes a source of new and false meanings. Delusions usually have attributed to them the following characteristics. They are held with absolute conviction. They are experienced as self-evident truths, usually of great personal significance. They are not amenable to reason or modifiable by experience. Their content is often fantastic or at best inherently unlikely. The beliefs are not shared by those of a common social or cultural background. Description of Bush and the way he operates in reality. Man. I just want to share with you what Benedict at Large sent me. Mike, sociopathic behavior is not inherited, but thus commonly occur across generations of the same family. Sociopathic behavior, then, is actually a learned trait, passed as it is from parent to child. It occurs, at least according to current thinking, when the young child receives no assurances of love from his or her parent figures. Somehow, and we don't fully understand this, this lack of love assurance prevents the natural development of empathy in the child. This lack of empathy is a lifelong affectation. While it can be treated effectively once the patient understands he or she suffers from it, they can never entirely recover. What they get from treatment is only the ability to recognize when they are doing it and a set of coping tools to employ when this happens. And as Dr. Frank said, sociopaths are extremely effective, ruthlessly so. Lacking any chance at self-fulfillment, they then set upon the task of destroying this in others. In denial, the only cure for a sociopath is isolation from society. Now think, Katrina, and how much better off those poor people were in the Astrodome. And her beautiful mind. Is it any wonder that George is a sociopath with a mother like Barbara and a career-minded but absent father? If he were anything except president of the most powerful nation ever, I might actually feel bad for George. If I believed in God, I might actually rest easy with my knowledge of his future punishment. But neither is so. And so George must go before he destroys all of us, right down to the very last person. Benedict at large. Oh, God. Well, I didn't hear anything from Dr. Frank that negates or modifies anything I have felt about this man, Bush, at all. If anything, Dr. Frank added a little bit of a dash of spice, a touch of pepper, a little bit of sriracha sauce, some garlic chips to an already mounting fear that I have of what's going to happen in this country over the next 12 months.
It's in the Gulf Coast countries' interests that there be a stable Iran. Iran that is capable of rejecting Iranian influence.
My God. This is from Mike? Mike, the mother, Barbara Bush, needs to go to D.C. and tell him he's a good boy and she loves him before he gets all of us, killed. Let's all send Barbara Bush an email and request some love. The doctor scared me sober during the show. Impeachment, my ass. Intervention is more like it. Mom, Barbara Bush, get your tired old ass down to D.C. and tell him he's a good boy. Like today. This is from Bruce in New Jersey. Hey, Mike, holy crap. How the hell do you make that protective blanket pillow thingy you make with Molly? Damn it. No time. I'm just going to have to squeeze under the bed. Bruce in New Jersey. P.S. I'm typing this from under my computer desk. Well, what you do, you get couch cushions and big pillows on the bed and blankets, and you make a fort. Come on, Bruce. You made a fort. And then you just... And you get lots of blankets. And don't forget, you got to have four or five stuffed animals, you know, so you've got, like, people you can talk to while you're, you know, in case your dad gets killed when the monsters attack, you've got your teddy bear and your puppy and your elephant, so you can, oh, man. It's just too scary. Now, all of a sudden, after what Dr. Frank said, you know, to the people who have been suggesting directly and obliquely to this program, what makes you think he's going to give up power next November and or January 09 or whatever? What makes you think he's going to give up power? You know, there are a number of scenarios that could play out where Bush could retain power. And I have more or less not poo-pooed those comments or tried to denigrate the person making them, but my attitude has been, oh, come on, nobody's that insane. knowing full well as I'm saying that, that this son of a bitch was insane enough to engineer one way or another the attack on this country on September 11, 2001. Don't send me emails and tell me I'm crazy and a tinfoil hat wear and all this other stuff. I've said it 1,000 times, and I'll continue to say it. The official story is not the story. If you believe it is, then fine, go listen to Limbaugh or Hannity or somebody. But no longer will I look at those kinds of suggestions or comments or worries from listeners. You know, what happens if Bush doesn't leave? With the same kind of, I'm sorry, but the only way I can think of is disdain that I've looked at those comments in the past. You know, I have. Nah, that could never be. Oh, come on, that's not going to happen. Oh, don't worry about it. Of course he'll leave. Nah, you know, that'll never... Boom, boom. Now, to everybody who has sent me an email along those lines, I apologize for, even if I didn't say anything disdainful to you, I was probably thinking it, so I apologize. I shouldn't need to have someone like Dr. Frank with three or four statements convince me that this man may not decide to leave, or the people behind him may not decide to leave. And if that happens, then you know what will happen next. You know, and I know. I mean, we all know. That's when the fourth box that is used in the defense of liberty will be opened, and we know this. And I can't believe I'm saying this. I can't believe I'm thinking it. I can't believe the possibility exists. Even a megalomaniac like Nixon had the sense to realize that his game was over and he had to leave, that he was one person out of what at the time? I don't know, 200 million of us, 210 million of us, I don't know, 250 million of us. Here now we have George Bush who doesn't see reality that way at all, not at all. You know, Nixon may have been disturbed, may have been neurotic, but he wasn't psychotic. And I don't think there's any question any longer that Bush is. And I realize that psychotic is a strong term, and I know we have therapists who listen to this program, and you'll probably, excuse me, disagree with that. And I would disagree with it, too, on certain levels. I'm not using it clinically, though, the way health professionals use it. Oh, okay. Yeah, let's have some Pink Floyd. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova. And your phone calls when we come back.
Cannot let terrorists and rogue nations hold this nation hostile or hold our allies hostile.
Yeah. Lynn writes, maybe that's why the Democrats seem so ineffectual. Possibly they are terrified. Ron in Briarwood, New York. Mike, tonight's show is scarier than your Halloween show. The chimp belongs not in the Oval Office, but in a rubber room. It's what we all knew, but coming from Dr. Frank, it is bone-chilling. Mary in Denver, a frightening illustration of how oblivious to Bush's malevolence our so-called leaders remain was the forced apology by Pete Stark for saying Bush sent troops to their deaths for his amusement. How spot-on Stark was. And now he's afraid, too. This is from Randy in San Francisco. Jesus K. Rice. Now I have to go get my script filled again. I was trying to get away from the ambience. That was effing scary. Randy in San Francisco. Yeah, well, drink some wine. Don't take that crappy ambient stuff. I tried to take one of those. Whoa! Those were awful. Linear Bob, Mike, the interview, Bush on the couch, scares me a lot. I didn't hear any mention of all those presidential directives that give Mr. Bush all manner of powers in the event of an emergency that he declares. All he needs to do is stage a false flag attack of some sort, and he can then declare a state of emergency and assume those dictatorial powers we heard and read about several months ago. I would not put staging a false flag operation beyond the likes of Blackwater. He doesn't even need to use the CIA. We now know he has the NSA looking at all of our emails and listening to all of our phone calls. Sorry for the really bleak thoughts, but I'm not sure 9/11 wasn't a false flag operation. I'm sure you and I are in agreement about those towers falling down way too quickly, and that is enough to prove the official version of what happened to be false. You're right, we might need to open that fourth box. I don't own a gun, and I don't want one, but I would certainly do whatever it takes to throw off the yoke of the oppressor in the form of our own military or a bunch of hired thugs like Blackwater. Linear Bob, listening to you streaming from KPHX because KKGN out here puts you on way too late. Yeah, well, I agree with that. All right, let's do some phone calls here before we run out of time. Lou is calling from Fort Drum, Florida, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Lou.
The previous emailer just had a good point about the martial law stuff and that when you see what they did in New Orleans, mm-hmm. taking guns away from people, and they say, oh, well, gee, the liberals, AMB, they want to take your guns.
Yeah.
This was Republicans that wanted to, that actually did this.
Yeah, that's how it, that's
nice
how
try.
Yeah, that's always been the joke. That's mm-hmm. always been the joke. It was liberals who wrote the Constitution. It was liberals who put the Second Amendment in there. It's been conservatives,
right.
reactionaries, and the what did Hitler do as soon as he took power?
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm so sick of right-wingers trying to blame liberals for the little bit that we've done, like saying, okay, we shouldn't have military-style
right.
weapons on the streets. And now I'm not so sure I agree with that anymore. Maybe we should have every kind of weapon available for what's coming.
Every day that goes by, I want to own a damn bazooka or something. It's just God.
I know.
And, you know, with the whole damn thing with Kucinich and the impeached Cheney thing, why don't the damn Democrats man up, hulk up, and for the love of God, shut down the government like Newt Gingrich did? You know, it was good enough because, oh, Bill Clinton, well, he, you know,
well, I think the Republicans knew Bill Clinton would declare a state of emergency
mm-hmm.
When Gingrich shut down the government. Clinton wouldn't declare a state of emergency and suspend elections and do what Musharraf has done in Pakistan, and all of a sudden the jig is up. I think maybe that's the reason. Maybe all of a sudden I got a little insight tonight into the mind of someone who is terrified, i.e. Nancy Pelosi, that if she does allow impeachment, I'm not saying I agree with this, but if she does allow impeachment to go forward, she'll have a plane accident, or a car will hit her as she's crossing the street, or an unknown mugger will come up and instead of stealing her purse, will choke her to death. You know, that's where we live now. So, Lou, I got to leave there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. Scott's calling from Federal Way, Washington, listening on KPTK. Hey, Scott.
Yeah, that's scarier than Michael Myers on Halloween.
Isn't it?
You should have had him on there. On Halloween. Well, in fact, you know, I heard his interview a couple of years ago. Mike Webb interviewed him about the time his book came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, when he was on there, I pretty much had the phone down because I had a hard time listening to it the first time. So.
I know what you mean.
So it was kind of hard to sit through that. Anyway, before I get to the HR thing, I just wanted to remind you again about that thing about Chuck Schumer. You know, remember I told you about his views about repealing the Patriot Act when Rosie O'Donnell asked him about that question.
Mm-hmm.
So him talking about McCasey and stuff, that's no surprise.
Right.
You know, he's just a useless piece of you-know-what.
Yeah, I think so.
But anyway, about the HR 33 thing, you know, and you know, part of me does want to commend Dennis, but then there is a part of me that's really kind of infuriated and kind of angry. As far as, you know, I think that part of it is kind of a political ploy on his part, and I will say this to say this, because Cynthia McKinney laid out articles of impeachment, laid out the case for impeachment for this.
Right.
And not one member of Congress backed her up, including
right.
Dennis Kucinich. And as a matter of fact, if you go back and actually read some of the stuff from that was coming from his camp, it was basically echoing what all these other Democrats were saying and all the stuff about, you know, everybody is worthy of forgiveness and all of this stuff.
Right.
I mean, she was the lone wolf that was out there that was asking the questions about 9/11, about impeachment, and about all of this, and not one person backed her about it. Where's the credit for her?
That's true.
And, you know, and I don't blame her for leaving the Democratic Party. They don't deserve her.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, you know, they're rotten for doing that.
Well, I live in Cynthia's district that's now represented by Hank Johnson, who, to his credit, was one of the people who is one of the co-signers, one of the 22 co-sponsors of Dennis's resolution. I don't know that much about Hank Johnson because he came out of nowhere. But if you could have lived here in the fourth congressional district here in Georgia, where Cynthia McKinney was a representative, the district had been rewritten to include a certain part of Gwinnett County that had a lot of white.
I watched the movie American Blackout. I learned all about that.
Well, it was horrifying. It was horrifying the way McKinney was labeled an anti-Semite.
Oh yeah,
it was just unbelievable. Now here's a fact. Her father Billy, who I've known longer than I've known Cynthia, Billy McKinney was in the Georgia House of Representatives here since Guy was a teenager. In my opinion, and I'm probably not qualified to say this, but in my opinion, Billy McKinney does have some problems where it concerns anti-Semitism. But that's him. He's an old man. He's a bitter, sour old man who got bitter and sour because he worked his ass off his entire life working for human rights and voting rights and so on and so forth, and just watched so many things crumble. So, you know, some people who wind up bitter old men have a right to be bitter old men, and I would imagine Billy McKinney is that way. But Cynthia, the attacks on her here in Metro Atlanta, in this area, the attacks on her were just astonishing. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, that tries to pride itself, its editorial page, on trying to be balanced. They have their liberals, they have their conservatives. They were merciless against Cynthia McKinney. So, yeah, I know. I watched it, Scott. I lived it. I know Cynthia. I know Cynthia. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not just a constituent. I know her.
And that's what even makes it worse, not even just by the right-wingers and all that old dirty crossover voting that went on down there.
That was just horrifying.
But even the progressives even joined in on that. That's what makes it even more infuriating to me. I think Cynthia McKinney is the one that really deserves the credit for bringing this forth, and I'm just not hearing that. So that's really what makes me angry about all of this.
I hear you. Scott, let me move on. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. All right, take care. Take care. There was no way for any of us either to ease the pain that McKinney felt. I mean, the attack on her was brutal, just brutal. Everything from her hair to one of the filthiest talk show hosts in America, this pig, Neil Bortz here, referred to her it was worse than nappy headed hoe. That was what's his name, the white boy that's going to get his job back. Bortz referred to her as, his reference was that she looked like a welfare hooker. It was awful. I mean, it was way beyond what Ima said, because what Neil Bortz said about Cynthia McKinney was just vicious and direct and focused. And he never let up. Bortz is another one of those white male pigs that eventually is going to wind up in the hell he created for himself. But the removal of Cynthia McKinney from office, and then her comeback, and then the removal again, it was just brutal. It was brutal. And those of us who did know her, some of us whites who are not real privy to the inner circle of her emotions, we didn't know what the hell to say. There was nothing we could say, except to stand back and watch her bleed. 10 before the hour. Thanks to our little band of radicals here at the Molloy Program. Ian Huff, Billy Foster, Chris in Minnesota, and Catherine Bay, our executive producer, for tonight's program. Where are we? Susan is calling from Calgary, Canada, listening via the internet. Hey, Susan.
Hey, I was calling about emails that were written in, and they were wondering about how people could even vote for Bush and what kind of people they would be. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of John Dean's book. I think he answered that, his book, Conservatives Without Conscience.
Right.
He talks about the authoritarian personality. They blindly follow, spoon-feed them. They don't have critical thinking. I think he pretty much laid out the case for the type of people that vote for Bush.
Yeah, this is one of the, that's one of the reasons that I sometimes get very pessimistic about the immediate future of this country. I would assume that Canadians have some sort of a firewall against an overspill of U.S. fascism. I hope so, anyway.
Well, that remains to be seen because Stephen Harper isn't much better.
Really?
No.
Well,
he's bought and paid for by Ralph Reed and his ilk.
Oh God. I don't know. I can't. I just feel like I can't emotionally afford to give up all hope. And sometimes it's a real battle, not against the forces of darkness, but it's a real battle just to maintain a sense of equilibrium or a sense of hope or a sense of thinking to myself, okay, look, we're going to get through this. We've gotten through, our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation got through very intense and equally dangerous situations in their lifetimes. We'll get through this. And it's just a matter of perseverance. And I think to myself, oh, my God, you sound like something that's stitched onto a pillow on somebody's living room, you know, like Home Sweet Home. It just sounds so platitudinous, I guess the word I'm looking for. But I've got to keep the hope. I've got to keep the faith that we'll get through this. Got to.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Susan. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Marge is calling from Indiana. Hey, Marge, welcome to the program. I wish you would have been able to hear some of that interview.
Yeah, well, just listening to the conversation about it, you know, it must be hell to be raised by Mom Barker. What can I tell you?
It must be.
Guess who's spending their first night in jail?
Who's spending a first night in jail?
In Oxnard, Wisconsin.
Don't know. Who?
Does the name George Ryan ring a bell?
Oh, former governor of Illinois. Is that right?
Guess who drove him to the gate?
You?
Hell no.
Oh, who?
His lawyer and former governor, Jim Thompson.
Oh, Jim Thompson. Big Jim Thompson, huh?
Isn't that interesting? You know, with one governor taking another governor to jail?
Yeah, there's almost poetic justice there. It's really a shame what happened to Ryan. Ryan was the governor, for folks who don't know, the governor of Illinois, who was convicted of all sorts of chicanery and fraud and double dealings. But he was also the man who three or four years ago declared an absolute moratorium on all death sentences. There was no more capital punishment in Illinois because Riot became convinced that innocent people were being executed.
Yeah, so anyhow, but that's not really why I called.
I know. You really called because...
I'm trying to remember something. Help me here. Once upon a time, didn't the OPEC countries get together periodically? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, we're going to pump so many barrels of oil per day, and we're going to charge X number of dollars per each barrel.
Right.
And then it stayed that way until the next time they decided to get together and smoke a peace pipe or whatever the hell they did at those meetings.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way anymore.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. When the hell did it suddenly become traded on the exchange, like soybeans and corn and commodities, and the speculators can just play hell with the price of oil?
It's been quite some time. What they're playing hell with
was that when Cheney had his little private meetings in the
well, no, I think it predates Cheney as vice president. Cheney's evil hands, bony, gnarly hands, have been in government since way back in the Reagan administration. He was around Ford. He was in the Ford administration. So Cheney goes way back. But you're right. The speculators are the ones.
It didn't used to be that way. You know, it's one thing being diddled, but damn it, you know, we're not even getting kissed.
Yeah, at least you ought to get some stamps or a kiss or a pat on the butt. And when you're not getting any of that in return, it is kind of weird. But you're right. That's what's going on. But it's based on some real understandings that the use of oil, Marge, I don't know that you and I will live to see the end of the age of oil, but I think our children or our grandchildren for sure will see that. It's happening. And as economies that have not planned for this demand more and more oil, of course it drives the price up.
Your friend Ski Anderson, you ever see him?
I don't see Ski. We talk to him occasionally.
Tell him I said hi. But he got me onto a book called America Who Really Pays the Taxes. And in there, there's a section on a deal in the desert.
A deal in the desert.
Yeah. Our good friends, like Chevron and Standard Oil and all that good stuff, we created this devil.
Yes, of course.
You know, like we've done in so many other cases.
Absolutely.
And we're still paying for it. I still would like to know when we shifted over from the OPEC to commodities.
All right, that's your assignment when you have all that free time to go to the library. look it up for us, okay?
Marge, I was looking for a little help from...
I know, but you don't get help from this show. All you get from this show is assignments.
You will be that way.
That's true. Be that way. Marge, take care. We got a boogie. I'll talk to you later. Oh, thank you for participating in the program tonight. However you did that, scary show. Next Halloween, let's have Dr. Frank on, Kathy. Much scarier than the Telltale Heart. I'll see you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is the Nova M Radio Network.